Well, hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today's guest is Alan Benzie, winner of BBC Scotland Young Musician, Young Jazz Musician at only 17. He's a pianist and composer and one of the UK's most exciting young talents. So before we talk to Alan, let's just check out this awesome track, The Warrior Who Became a Tiger. Alan Benzie, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Sun's out, maybe for a while. So.
Whereabouts do you live?
I live in Glasgow.
Oh, lovely. I'm down in London, but it seems we're sharing this beautiful weather.
Yeah, well, happy days.
Yes, yes. So, so many questions. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Glasgow.
Sure.
Have you always lived there?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, apart from being away for college, I'm forgetting actually. For secondary school, I was kind of in Edinburgh. But apart from that, I've lived in Glasgow. All my life. I don't really sound like it. Which perhaps some would say is a good thing, some would say is a bad thing, I don't know.
I love the Glasgow accent.
Yeah, and I don't really have it, so sorry to disappoint you and potentially some listeners if they love it too. But but I have found that a lot of people say, especially people coming from abroad, that I'm one of the easier people to understand that they've met in Glasgow. So
that's good.
But my family are all from the northeast, up around Aberdeen and near Aberdeen. So
yeah.
I'm not sure I sound like that either, to be honest. But so I don't think I've ever really sounded truly Glaswegian. But I feel Glaswegian. I love Glasgow. So
does the accent get softer as you go further north?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Okay. Yeah, I was in a shop in Glasgow last year watching a girl at a till, you know, with a really strong accent, trying to talk to some Americans. And it was great to watch because it just wasn't working. It was as if they were like speaking completely different languages.
Yes, yeah. And I bet it can feel like that sometimes, for sure. So.
And you studied in America for a while.
Yes, I was at Berklee College of Music in Boston for 4 years.
Okay. How did your accent go down over there?
A mixture. I think probably any Scot who's, and in fact, probably any Brit of various accents will have experienced some similar things. over there, you know. So what I got was a variety of things. A lot of people would be like, "Oh, I love your accent." Some people would struggle to understand what I was saying. Quite a lot of people wanted me to do an impression of Shrek, or that character from Austin Powers. But you know, and I was going, right, so you want me to do an impression of a Canadian guy doing an impression of the accent where I'm from? Okay. Yeah. there's a challenge. But you know, no, for the most part it was very, very friendly. But I did find myself, I think, softening my accent probably. It perhaps somewhat unconsciously, but so that people could understand me better. So
yeah. So let's go back in time to the beginning. You started on the violin.
Oh, I did. Yeah, that's right. I'm actually looking at my violin case right now.
Oh, great.
I just got back. Yeah, I didn't have it for a while, and I've kind of got it back in the last few months.
Is it fun to play?
Do you know, it's fun to play now. And obviously, I mean, I totally fell in love with the violin, and that's how I started playing music. So when I started, obviously, I loved the violin, had a wonderful teacher. And that's, yeah, that kind of, I played violin until I was 16 or so, I think.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why I ended up in Edinburgh for secondary school. I went to kind of a music school there to do classical violin.
Yeah. What's the school called there? I forget.
It's called St. Mary's Music School. So yeah, went to do that and so loved it initially, and then later on less so, and got super excited about playing jazz piano. But yeah, it's been kind of fun to take it out and just play a little bit. It sounds terrible. Some things remain, but the intonation is really bad. But it's cool because I found that I can kind of play jazz on it, which I could never do.
Yeah,
you know, as a classical violinist. So it's funny that the knowledge kind of can transfer over, even if it sounds bad.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I find that really hard between my like saxophone and flute, especially. Like,
oh right, okay.
It just doesn't. I don't know if it's because they're in a different key, but I'm just hopeless. Yeah. I was like classically trained on the flute, and that's it. Like, I can be all over some long notes, but like playing a standard's a bloody nightmare.
Yeah, well, I was fine with like all of me, and then I tried to play. What was it? Which, you know, obviously, which is in C, so like a lot of it's relatively friendly.
Yeah.
You know, but then I tried to play something in E flat, and it was just like a bad idea.
So, how did you decide, like at an early age, that a music school was the place for you?
I don't think it was that as such. I mean, I think I probably, in some ways, maybe have my mum to thank. For kind of just being, probably doing some research or kind of being aware of the options. So I suppose I can't say that it was my decision to check it out in the first place, because I'm not sure that I knew that they existed, because I would have been, what, I think around about 10 when I auditioned.
Right.
But I did know that I wanted to do music with my life.
Yeah.
And so we went to, I think it was probably an open day over there. And I have to admit, I don't remember much about it, but I do remember thinking, oh, there's something kind of magical about this place.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, apparently I did come back awfully excited and saying that I wanted to go. So.
Oh, cool. Were you ever any good at anything else? Or was this a very easy...
I mean, I hesitate to say that I was good at other stuff, and I'm told that I was, but I mean, I absolutely adored football then. Yeah. I probably played more football than I did practice music.
Yeah.
But, of course, listeners can't see me now, but anyone who knows me knows that I'm really short. I'm like 5'3" or thereabouts. So what's that, 160 something ish? So it's just as well that I didn't pursue football, because I think, I mean, if you're not a certain height, I think they pretty much kick you out by the time you're about 13 or something. That's pretty brutal. But I did absolutely love football a lot, and various things. I mean, I've always been interested in lots of different subjects in a fairly what's the word, shallow way. but I think I'm definitely glad that music is what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I play a lot in goal, and whenever I let a goal in, I instantly blame that I'm only 5'11".
Okay. Well, in that case, I should definitely play a goal then.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. The goals are 14 foot wide, and I'm like, do the maths, guys. You know, just, what would you want from me?
That's what Ethan Iverson says if he's in goal.
Excellent.
No, yeah. Yeah, so...
Sorry, that went right over my head, didn't it?
Perhaps. Sorry, is that what you say when you're in goal, or is that...
Well, oh, right, no, that, yeah, also, sorry, I see. Yeah. I'm starting to realise, Alan, that your mind works much quicker than mine, you know. Well, I'm the kind of guy, like, you've got to explain the joke several times and then I'll get it. It's not very, not very appealing quality.
I'm sure that's very modest.
So yeah. How did the piano come into the picture then?
Well, I did play piano. God, now when did I start playing piano? I can't remember, but as a second instrument. And I mean, at St. Mary's, that's a requirement. So you kind of, if you don't play piano already, you have to kind of take it up as a second instrument.
Right.
But I did already play a little bit, but it's funny. I do remember one, I don't know, quote, I guess, from someone who, after I'd said that I wanted to start playing jazz piano, who said that they were concerned because my piano playing was rudimentary at best.
Wow.
That might have been a bit harsh. I don't know, but or it might have been a fair comment. But yeah, and it's something that I do, I think, regret a little bit now, is kind of not practicing classical piano a little bit more. I had a great teacher at St. Mary's, Margaret Wakeford, shout out. She was just a great teacher, you know, fantastic person. It's really stuck with me despite the fact that I just didn't practice. And I think whatever piano skill I did possess is probably thanks to her just refusing to
stop,
basically, which is great. Yeah. But it is funny because, you know, a lot of reviews and stuff of my music, you know, you'll hear people say, oh, you can really hear his classical piano training. And it's funny because I often feel like a bit of a charlatan that way. Maybe I shouldn't admit that. I don't know. Yeah, I had obviously a fairly strong classical training on the violin.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kind of perhaps not the classical training that people might think on the piano.
That's very interesting. That's the point in our lives where we cross over perfectly, because I had an almost identical call once from the school I was at to my mum, being like, this guy's piano playing is so bad. Like, we're not going to let him do jazz until he sorts his life out. You know, this is a
piano equals life at this point.
Yeah. And now I regret deeply being so utterly, like, every day I seem to use it in like teaching or in school. And every day I'm like, oh, I should have done more practice.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we feel like that with everything. I mean, I suppose in theory you always could have done more.
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's a really useful instrument, isn't it? And so I can see why, you know, people would be asked to do it as a second study or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I do wish sometimes that I'd done that more fervently.
So when did the jazz kick in?
Jazz kicked in, I mean, when I went to St Mary's, they had these things called jazz days, which...
I like that, allocated day for jazz.
Yes, I know, it's quite funny. And it was a kind of predominantly classical, I suppose it probably still is predominantly classical.
Yeah.
Although it's, I think, a lot broader now than it was when I was there. But yeah, I mean, I suppose it's cool that they had a jazz thing at all. But yeah, it was once a month with a guy called Richard Ingham.
I know Richard.
You know Richard?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't expect to hear any names that would, you know, make the light bulbs. Not yet, anyway. So.
Not yet, right, yeah. Yeah, Richard's brilliant. I mean, and if you know Richard, he's got this energy, enthusiasm about him. And it's split by year group. I'm trying to think it was, you know, like S1 and S2 and S3 and S4 together, something like that.
Yeah.
Or if it was just in separate years. But we went along to this jazz day thing, and I just had an absolute ball. And this was playing violin at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just like, okay, teach you a little tune by ear, you know, and then here's some notes, you know, and then, right, you, four bars. Okay, you, four bars, you know. And I think for many of my colleagues, and I hope this isn't unfair to say, but that was a fairly terrifying experience.
Yeah.
To suddenly be told, right, here's four bars, make something up. Whereas I was just like, yes. What do you mean I only get four bars?
Yeah.
You know, give me more. So I think in some ways that's where it started. I mean, jazz probably will have been on amongst many other musics in the house.
Yeah.
Growing up. So I think it's not like it was a completely foreign concept to me, although it was more like kind of your ECM, a lot of like Jan Garbrecht.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. I was kind of quite into that. But yeah, I just thought it was really fun. And then there was a guy a few years above me at the school called Jamie Chambers, and he played quite pretty good jazz piano, and I just thought he was super cool.
Yeah.
and I thought, oh, well, I'd like to be able to do that. And then he introduced me to a band called EST, Ezra and Spencer Trio.
Yeah.
And ended up going to see them live, and then I was like, okay, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, it kind of all, I think, kind of stemmed from there, really.
What is it about EST that really grabbed you?
I think that's a really good question, and I wish I could go back and hear it fresh again for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I think EST was an entry point to jazz for a lot of people, quite overtly. It's like strongly melodic, groovy.
Mm-hmm.
Their togetherness as a band, energy, and yeah, those things were. I mean, to see them live was quite a special thing. I think just their connection with each other.
Yeah, because they were kind of renowned for not really playing with anyone else. The three guys in that band.
Yeah. And I think they kind of, like, they secretly maybe did one or two other things, but it was, like, wasn't really spoken about. So, yeah, I think, yeah, definitely loved the music. And I actually had the great fortune to kind of meet Esbjörn. When they came to Scotland, I was there.
Yeah.
At the front.
Yeah.
He was often kind of willing to take the time to chat to me after the shows, which I was just like completely starstruck, you know. But it was, I mean, and I'd be there for like an hour after the show, you know. And you know what it is like after you finish playing a gig, you know, especially their gigs are, they're on tour, and like, you know, they might have been in like Italy the night before, they'd be in Germany the next day. you know, to take that much time to speak to this, like, you know, wee boy.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was just, like, so generous. And so I think that was maybe also part of it as well, is that, you know, I just asked him on there. And now, God, I think, what if I could go back and ask other questions?
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so that was definitely a big thing. And I think unconsciously as well, because I hadn't really learned about transcribing, which for jazz musicians is, you know, that's an important thing. It's kind of, for anyone that's listening that's maybe not a jazz musician, it's a kind of figuring out what other jazz musicians, or not even jazz musicians, I suppose, but, you know, other musicians and music is what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I just liked the music so much that I wanted to play it. So I was kind of trying to figure out the tunes off the records and the solos and stuff, which I couldn't really do very well. But so I'd kind of started transcribing kind of just because I was so enthusiastic about the music.
Yeah, yeah. How was Berkeley?
Berkeley, yeah, intense.
What made you want to go there? I mean, I don't want to ask stupid questions, but
yeah,
because it's a really awesome place to go and study. But like, right, before you first went there, like, what was the draw for that place as opposed to like staying? Because if you'd have stayed in Scotland, your tuition would have been free.
Yes, although if I'd stayed in Scotland, of course, because now there's the RCS course in Glasgow that Tommy Smith heads up.
Yeah.
But like a
jazz course.
Like a jazz undergrad course. Yeah. And they've got a master's as well.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. But that didn't exist.
Right. Okay.
When I was at that age. But yeah, I studied for a couple of years with Steve Hamilton, wonderful Scottish jazz pianist, and still like one of my heroes, you know. And he had been to Berkeley, and obviously Tommy Smith had been at Berkeley as well. And I studied with Steve, and then was also in Tommy's like youth jazz orchestra.
Yeah.
So I guess they were two of like the role models that I had quite close to hand.
Yeah.
And so I think that naturally made me interested. It was like, well, if they went there, you know, it might be good.
Yeah.
It might be good today. So I think, yeah, that was the interest. And then I think I was probably also interested to go to America and, you know, see what it was like over there, you know, the birthplace of the music.
Of course. What was it like over there?
It was intense. I'm gonna, you know, in Scotland I'd just won Scottish young jazz musician of the year. You know, I was playing gigs and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I think it was really great to have gone to, although I suppose a lot of people will have experienced this even without, you know, don't have to go to America for this, but I definitely got there and went, oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the level.
Yeah.
And that was a very important and good thing. Because I'm not going to say I was arrogant, but I thought I was doing pretty well.
Yeah.
So that was really good. Yeah, quite intense. I mean, I was so overjoyed to be somewhere though where I was kind of surrounded by people that liked the kind of stuff I liked.
Yeah.
And that wanted to do the kind of things I wanted to do and shed and play together, jam and do all of that. I was just, because at St. Mary's, there were some good jazzers there. But, you know, when I formed my first group, I had to kind of, like, chivvy everyone to come and play and, like, carry drums across the school and like, you know, just to be somewhere where everyone was kind of as enthusiastic as me about the music I loved was so exciting. So I was really, really happy. But it was intense as well, for sure. A lot of hard work.
Yeah. And then, let's talk. So then when you got back to, you moved back to Glasgow after that, or you did a master's as well?
No, I just moved back to Glasgow.
Okay, cool. And then your debut album, Traveller's Tales, how long after your coming back did that get released?
We came back in 2011 and we released it in 2015.
Yeah.
I should say that with more confidence.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at it right now. And
are you okay?
Yeah, that's the one. And I'm like telling you, you're right about your own life. Correct answer, 2015.
Yeah, so that'd be 4 years, I think.
Yeah.
God, it's great. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so four years, I think. Which was good, I think. So I came back and then it was forming the actual trio that's on the record and that we're still together now. I think that was a year or so, a bit, year and a half maybe, after I came back.
Yeah.
And then we had a couple of years just kind of doing some mini tours and kind of just getting to the point where I felt we were ready to make an album.
Yeah. So Andy Robb, your bassist, he lived in London for a while and then in like Scandinavia for a while.
He was in Norway, yeah.
Yeah, is it hard to like keep pinning him down? Like it's really amazing that you guys are still playing as a trio when he's moved around so much.
Totally. Well, and not only Andrew, I mean, so I've known Andrew since we were about 13. So we played in the National Children's Orchestra of Scotland together when I was playing violin.
Sweet.
So that's cool. So, I mean, we've always kept in touch. Obviously he was moving around a fair bit. And then Marton, the drummer, we were at Berkeley together. He's Hungarian, so he was back in Hungary for a bit, and then he was in Vienna. Now he's in Switzerland. And then, as you say, Andrew's in London and then in Norway. So, yeah, it's not been easy.
Wow, that's amazing.
I did have people in Scotland be like, Alan, why don't you just have a trio of Scottish musicians? What are you doing? But for me, these were just the guys that I wanted to make that music with.
Yeah.
And I feel very strongly that it's been worth it. And the album that we released this year, Little Mysteries, was, I guess, part of calling it that was that we've kind of had so many little mysteries, I guess, in that band.
Yeah.
But many of which to do with, you know, were to do with, are we going to be able to keep doing it, you know? just because everyone was so far away. But it's been just great, and they're both amazing musicians and great people. So we've been able to deal with that. And now Andrew's back in Scotland, so that's just great to be able to pop through to Edinburgh and, you know.
Yeah, that's really cool to be suddenly only like 90 minutes apart or something.
Yeah, it's brilliant. You know, you're like, oh, it's great. So,
then... what changed between those two albums? Did the first album change your way of thinking about making another one?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think it may have confirmed some things and then some others may have changed. I think they're actually in some ways quite similar, the two albums, in their inspirations.
Yeah. So
like most of my tunes have like little wee kind of stories behind them.
Yeah.
That are inspired by, you know, traveling about and seeing different things. It might be landscapes, but definitely also a lot of stuff from reading books and watching, you know, a kind of anime and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just little kind of ideas and little stories. So that's a common thread between the two of them, I would say. I suppose the second record, Andrew, we've got a couple of his tunes on the second album, so that's really nice because the first album's all my tunes.
Yeah.
And I think the first album had a very strong concept that I'd kind of, I guess, with it being the first record, I'd kind of developed that over quite a long time.
Yeah.
So I really had a kind of strong idea of what I wanted to do with it. And I think the second album maybe came a little bit more organically, just out of what we were doing with the trio. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I was just totally agreeing with you about the first album thing being something that's like brews up over your entire like musical lifetime.
Yeah. And then like, because they do say that, don't they, about the problematic second album, because your first album's got like however many years of life in it.
Yeah.
Then it's like, you know, then the second one's got a year or like two years. So, but I mean, I think that's something that's really important for me, is to have things outside, you know, to try and live some life.
Yeah.
And have something to write about and to, you know.
Totally. I think what you're trying to do is establish an emotional connection with people. And if you haven't got anything to play about, then it's just, it's not the same.
Yeah, that's definitely what I think. So something interesting behind the music. Also true of the Apollo project, I suppose. You know, that's your thing. That like some interesting driving thing, you know, and then that's something that people can kind of a kind of an entry point, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, and I really struggle to imagine like life after, like, because that will be my first album.
Yeah.
To even consider how to make a second one right now, of course, is like an incomprehensible issue.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, definitely after we released the first album, I was like, okay, I'm never going to be able to do another one. I have nothing. But I guess it comes along.
Yeah.
Although it was a good while. I mean, that was 3 years between the first one and the second one.
Yeah, that's a good amount. I mean, that still seems very impressive.
Right. You know?
I mean, like, I wrote this Gods of Apollo thing in 2011, and it's taken till now to kind of chisel it down and make it exactly how it's, but you know, so.
Maybe that's good, though. I mean, I do think that, a lot of good art takes time.
Yeah.
Right, it takes time. And if you could just throw stuff out there and it would be amazing, then everything would be amazing.
Yeah.
I suppose. So it's good to, I think it's good for things to take time. And I suppose even more so when we live in, you know, a world where things are quite instantaneous and short form.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. It's good to still be doing things that take time, both in the creating and the experiencing.
Yeah, I mean,
but that's what I think anyway.
I always try and use like Michael Brecker's, I think his first album, he was 39 or so.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's quite like when you look back now, like nobody would ever except me think to care about that. But I like how actually that's pretty late, you know.
Yeah. Totally. And these days the way things are, you're definitely encouraged to be like making, or at least recording, even if you're not making an album.
But, yeah.
Recording things and putting it out there, you know, from really early on.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting dynamic, isn't it? You know, I wonder if that changes the creative process as a whole.
Yeah.
Now, interesting thought.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, social media and all recording and stuff, it must do. Like, you know, for Mike Brecker, and like his first album was 1987. So before that, you can kind of just, you can probably work a little more secretly.
Then
I don't know. I feel like now if you tried to do that, everyone would just think that you don't care.
Or that you're anti-social media or something.
Yeah, totally. But anyway, can we talk about your incredible ability to speak Japanese?
I might not phrase it quite like that, but
it's not like, it's not a European language, it doesn't share lots of common strands, like
true,
it's really something.
true. I mean, well, I suppose the only disclaimer I'll say is, like, however many million Japanese people speak it, so it is eminently possible.
Yes, no, that's fair.
No, I know what you mean, and I think a lot of people, I suppose we should, yeah. Okay, so I had a lot of Japanese friends at Berkeley, and I just thought it sounded really nice. I guess the few experiences that I'd had with the language before that, you know, if you see maybe films from Japan, a lot of them, you know, there's a lot of famous, like, gangster out of Japan, the Yakuza stuff. Or so a lot of people, when they do, you know, when they try to produce the sound of what Japanese sounds like to them, it's this kind of, like, quite clipped, aggressive kind of thing that they do. But listening to people speak everyday conversational Japanese, it's got a lovely flow about it. So I really liked the sound. And then when I came back to Glasgow, I'm going to admit here, right, that I love music, and it's my life, but I can't, like, practice piano 8 hours a day.
Yeah,
it's just not me. And especially after having 4 quite intense years at Berkeley, I wanted something else to kind of fill up my time. And, you know, having just graduated and, you know, wasn't playing tons of gigs or kind of doing loads of stuff, you know. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted something to do with my time. And I thought, well, you know, I've learned a few phrases of Japanese from my friends and I think it sounds really nice, but I've not really got my teeth into it. So maybe I'll give that a go. It's really...
How did you start learning it then? What did you use?
Well, I started learning, trying to learn, like, some of the writing stuff. Mm-hmm. Just kind of by rote, and I was trying to kind of learn vocabulary and grammar, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I stumbled across this website called All Japanese All the Time.
What a great name for a website. Right?
Yeah. and I was like, what? That sounds interesting. And the guy was just, I mean, a very entertaining and persuasive writer. On the subject, not just of learning Japanese, but actually of kind of learning anything, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But just with the specifics being about Japanese. And his whole thing was like, throw away your textbooks, don't go to class, you know, whatever, but like just create a world around you that immerses you in whatever it is that you're, you know, trying to learn.
Yeah.
So, and make sure that it's something that's enjoyable and that you're going to gravitate towards. So he was like, if you like watching, you know, anime, watch tons of that. If you like dramas, watch Japanese drama. If you like radio, listen to the radio. If you like this kind of, you know, but whatever it is that you do, do it in Japanese.
Yeah.
He was just very persuasive writing about that and about how to learn some of the writing as well. I basically just did what he said to do on the website, and it worked out really well.
How do you pick up words from like watching, like, was it like, because I imagine the learning curve, it feels quite steep.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think that's the good thing about it is that, if you're doing it, doing something in a more immersive way, I think it does feel slower initially because you're not learning lists of vocabulary and you're not learning grammatical structures. So what that does for you early in a process is it allows you to, you know, to put together building blocks of information and then produce some kind of larger chunks of information, I guess, right? So like... Yeah. know, then you can go, okay, well, I need this word from the list of vocabulary I learned, and then this grammatical structure does this. So if I want to say this, I do this. And it's really halting and it's really slow, but you're able to kind of produce the information.
Yeah.
In a kind of quite a rote way. But I think if you learn something immersively, it's you spend like 6 months having no idea what's going on. But then when you do, when things click, it has more, I guess, more flow and more intuitiveness, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I did, I mean, I was learning little bits of vocabulary anyway, but I was watching things with subtitles, I suppose. And yeah, I think, yeah, you know, you would pick up, you know, hearing the same things however many times. Eventually you'd go, oh, hang on a minute, I've heard that before.
Yeah, yeah.
What's that? And what does that say? That means, okay. So you're kind of learning to express, I guess, larger chunks, you know, so that instead of learning how are you today, all the separate things.
Yeah, yeah.
And whatever, you would just kind of learn the expression, how to express that.
Yeah, yeah.
That thing. So it was really, really, really interesting to learn something that way.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
It was really fun because I just kind of like did stuff that I liked doing, you know.
Yeah.
But in another language. So
yeah. You know what would do it for me? Because I love this idea.
Yeah.
My wife learns some French, and I interfere in Russian. Like, I love Russian and
interfere in Russian.
I don't want to say learn it because I'm really.
I love that.
Yeah, like to sort of interfere with the language. There's a show on BBC Four called Missions, and it's the only thing I'd ever seen that was both in French and Russian with English subtitles.
Brilliant!
I know, it was so great. Absolutely, dream come true. But I think I might start trying to play computer games with the sound in Russian and the subtitles in English. I think that would be...
If you can do that, I mean, God knows I would do that.
I'll be fluent in like a fortnight.
You'd be fluent in Fortnite.
In a fortnight. Yeah, exactly. Oh,
sorry, that's a games joke for anyone that's...
Everyone must know about Fortnite.
Sure, it's pretty famous, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, and it surprises me. I love video games, and like it's one of my vices.
Mm-hmm.
But funnily enough, I didn't play any games in Japanese. Which, looking back on that now, I'm like, why didn't? Or, I probably could still do that, I suppose.
Yeah, because there's some really like Metal Gear Solid is one of my favorite Japanese games. I love that.
Yeah, brilliant.
But I've never played it in Japanese, of course.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I'd be to do it in Russian, I suppose. But I think it's really cool. And I know that as well that when I'm kind of teaching music or people ask for advice, younger people kind of getting into, it might be jazz or it might even just be jazz-related musics.
Yeah.
But I think, again, a lot of people learning music initially, they kind of want... specific pieces of information, a kind of how-to.
Yeah.
And actually, well, you know, and obviously it's good to learn the theory and all that stuff. I do think that's important. But I actually kind of say to them, well, what do you like? And, you know, can you follow that wormhole of the music that you're into? Can you get deeper about that? And learn about the people that are making it and who do they play with and then who do they play with and just really get inside that sound.
Yeah.
Just immerse yourself in the sound. And then when you learn how it's constructed, it's got some kind of sonic framework to fit into, I guess. And I think learning Japanese... it kind of in that immersive way kind of helped give me that perspective, I suppose.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And yeah, that is the advice I would want to give to someone wanting to learn jazz, you know. You want to go and listen to everything.
Yeah,
all
totally.
The time.
And love it, because if you don't love it,
yeah,
you know, it's going to be hard to learn anything. So go and listen to it and just love, just fall in love with it.
Yeah. Let's talk about then this last track that we're going to play. Is it pronounced Natsume? Oh.
Natsume, yeah.
Oh, yes. No, it looks really cool.
Is, in fact, Japan related. So it's one of my favorite anime. It's called Natsume Yūjincho, which means Natsume's Book of Friends. And oh, nice. That's one of the things that I watched a lot of when I was learning Japanese. And it's just, it's beautiful. Sure, it's kind of about spirits, I suppose. Kind of, he's able to see these spirits. So it's a variety of kind of, it's quite warm-hearted. It's a little bit dark in places, a little bit funny, a little bit all sorts of things, a little bit quirky. And it's got a fantastic soundtrack, actually, also written by a jazz pianist. But it's got kind of bassoon and like the orchestration is great. But yeah, so I was just kind of, when I wrote this, it was kind of with the vibe of that show in mind.
That's awesome. I'm going to play it.
Cool.
Alan, it's been a massive pleasure. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you so much.
On the Jazz Podcast.
Delighted.
Yeah, we've had a stunning time. That was a beautiful life lesson. Was I loved it. Now I'm going to go and listen to it like a fan, like play it all again.
Oh, well, thanks so much. Yeah. No, it's a total pleasure. As I say, I've been listening to the podcast myself and loving it. So it's really just fantastic to come on. So thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Well, we'll speak to you soon. We'll keep an eye out for the 2021 third album.
That's right. I'm hoping we might get to it before that. Yeah. But yeah. Let's make that the late deadline.
Oh, I like that. That's the maximum.
Yeah.
Sick. All right. Awesome. Cheers, buddy.
Thanks, Rob.